Professor Roger Trigg from Warwick. Roger, you are very welcome.
Well, thank you very much, and I'm very pleased to be here and back in Belfast. Most times when I've been to Belfast before, I've been to Queen's University, so I'm very glad to be able to make contact with the wider community. I'm almost tempted to say with real people. Now, another thing I was rather pleased about was to notice that the title today, Equality, Freedom and Religion, was actually the title of one of my books. I don't know if that was intentional or not, but anyway, I was pleased to see that. My own subject is in particular the plight of religious freedom in a secular society. And I think we have to face the fact that religion is in fact facing more and more overt aggression in many places. You may not quite feel it so much here in Northern Ireland, I'm not so sure, but in England, because perhaps of the weakening of the churches over particularly the last 20 years, and the rise of an aggressive atheism, a militant atheism, one finds that religion is more and more on the defensive. And Europe as a whole is becoming more aggressively secular. And I think it's worth just pointing out that actually that is not the experience of most people in most parts of the world. Now, at the moment, I'm just talking about religion, not just Christianity. But you notice that religion in many parts of the world is becoming more influential. Christianity is in places like Africa and Latin America. And Islam, of course, is becoming ever more powerful in other parts of the world and sometimes in the same parts, as witness Nigeria. So, Western Europe is the odd one out. It's not like even the United States. It isn't as if it's the West versus the rest. And in fact, views about secularization that used to be very popular when I started out in the 1960s in sociology, about the inevitable advance of the progress of science, of the way in which science would push back religion, have just been proved to be false. Religion is on the up and up, as I've said. So we sometimes, I think, shouldn't be too discouraged in the West. We're the odd ones out. But nevertheless, we have a particular problem in Europe. And this can take the form of campaigns for freedom from religion. Religion is seen as a threat, a danger, rather than freedom for religion, which is what I would want to champion. In the face of religious extremism, now particularly, of course, coming from radical Islamism, we're told that to protect civil democratic society, and this comes from a book I was just reading, religious rights need to be curtailed. Now, I think you can see where that's coming from. People are looking at perhaps what's going on in some branches of Islam, and they get frightened. This actually came up in the Conservative Party conference last week when the Home Secretary was talking about the need to safeguard all of us from what she termed religious extremism. Now, of course, I live in the middle of England, not very far from Birmingham, and there are parts of Birmingham where you can see the rise of radical Islam because there are real ghettos there where people actually don't have much contact with the ordinary inhabitants of Birmingham. I say ordinary inhabitants in the sense that the people who were there 50 years ago. I'm now based in Oxford and with a research centre in Oxford. And not long ago, I was talking in my college to a very bright doctorate student. She'd just come from Bangladesh. She was very fluent in English, although she'd never actually set foot outside Bangladesh. She was a sociologist, very eager to start her work, and I was asking how she was getting on. Well, of course, the first thing she had to do is to find housing. And to do that, she'd stayed with a Bangladeshi family while she looked for a flat. And she stayed with a Bangladeshi family on a rather insalubrious housing estate in Oxford, and there are those. And in fact, I said, well, how are you getting on, and how have you settled into England? And she said, there's one thing that really shocked me. And I thought, here goes, what's she going to say about us? And she said, you know, I've been living with this Bangladeshi family for a few weeks,
and the wife has lived in Oxford for 25 years and cannot speak a word of English. And there was this girl who did not set foot in England more than 6 weeks before and spoke perfect English. And that just shows how some Islamists can thrive on the isolation of people. It isn't so much the women who still live as if they're in their Bangladeshi village. It's their children. What happens to them when they go to school? They either get alienated from their families or they get dragged into a very extreme Islamist outlook, which involves some of them even going off to fight in the Middle East. Now, that's the kind of thing that Theresa May was worried about. And, of course, it's the kind of thing we all should be worried about, that religion can produce some pretty terrible outcomes. But I was worried about the way in which she talked about religious extremism and the way she defined it and the way in which she talked about it fomenting hatred against sections of the community. And I thought, wait a minute, what would that say if you applied it to, say, a Christian wanting to make a rational case against homosexual practices? All too often, they might be accused of homophobia. They might be told that they're religious extremists. And that might then be told that sanctions have to come against them. Now, that has happened in England already. How do you get to that situation? How can people attacking religious extremism suddenly see that the expression of really a philosophical view about something can itself seem an extremist attack, an expression of intolerance? Now, secular egalitarians argue that to say that someone's way of life is immoral is necessarily to imply that that person is of lesser worth. You're attacking me, that's saying that you think I'm nothing. Not just you disagree with me, you have one view, I have another, and we should talk about it. Equal concern and respect, in some people's eyes, isn't just a matter of external behaviour, it's a matter of internal attitudes. It's not just that you mustn't stop me doing what I want, it's that you must respect my right to do it, my respect my doing it, even, approve of my doing it. And I think that that takes us into a different realm where I'm being told what I must think. Incidentally, I think that that twists round another problem in this area, where people who are religious are often told that, of course, you have religious freedom. Of course, religious freedom is important, but it's a private concern. It's a matter for you and what you do on Sunday. Sometimes political leaders significantly talk about freedom of worship, not freedom of religion. Now, freedom of worship is terribly important, but if it's only freedom of worship, what they're saying is, go to church on Sunday, but keep quiet about it for the rest of the week. And this is all part of a general tendency in our society to want to privatise religion. Another of my books was about religion in public life with the subtitle, Must Religion Be Privatised? And there's a definite attempt nowadays by many people to make the state neutral, to make the state stand back from all views. And the corollary of that is to say that religious people are entitled to their views, but not to put them, impose them on other people, and not to express them in the public place. Religion is then driven out of public life. Religion is made private and personal. And then religion is rendered powerless to influence or contribute to public discussion. Very often it's a matter of faith and reason. And some people say, well, of course, it's your faith. Meaning, don't you talk about it to me. It's not a matter of rationality. Now, I, as a philosopher, always jib at that very much. Faith is always faith in something. Faith is always faith in somebody. If you have faith in your doctor and he was knocked down by a bus this morning, your faith is misplaced. Faith in God implies there is a God. Faith that there is a God implies that I hope you have reasons for thinking that. Not necessarily reasons that give knockdown proofs, but not just saying, oh, it's a nice feeling I have, it helps me, I don't know if it's true or not. It's a claim to truth, and if it's true, it's true for everybody. So faith and reason can't be separated. Faith is made subjective, reason is meant to be something that's public. If you separate them, what you're saying is, yes, have your faith, don't bring it out into public. It's got nothing to do with the weekday life of the nation. And I think that itself is very dangerous. So we're facing a situation where religion is being attacked, it's being turned into something private, where secular egalitarians have taken over the notion of equality and made it into something that I don't think it is. And therefore, we get to a situation where, to quote a book again I was reading, that there is a fundamental conflict between traditional religion and the emerging egalitarian orthodoxy. Now, of course, when I talk about faith and reason, one of the things that I'm implying is, of course, that religious belief is not just something personal for me. And I think it's terribly important that all religion starts with the individual. All religion starts with personal holiness and individual commitment. If you don't start with that, if you don't start with the person's relationship with God, you're finished. But you don't end with that. It has to work out in your life. Belief isn't just a propositional belief, assent to a set of propositions. It isn't just thinking the right things on Sunday, as I've said. It's also intimately linked with practice. By their fruits you shall know them. And unless we as Christians behave differently in our professional lives and throughout all our public life, unless our Christianity infuses that, what's it worth? So I don't think belief and practice can be separated. This is terribly important from a legal point of view, actually, because in the European Convention of Human Rights, there is an absolute right to religious freedom in the sense that you can believe what you want. But there is a very conditional right on manifesting that belief. The manifestation of belief is hedged round with all kinds of conditions. And at that point, of course, it looks as if people can say very magnanimously, you have religious freedom. Of course you have. But don't express it in this way. Don't express it in that. Don't ride roughshod of other people's rights. And at that point, they don't appreciate enough, I think, that belief and practice are, for the Christian, indeed for the Muslim, for other religions, they're intimately related. That a belief about what's important in life is bound to colour your view not only about what's good, but therefore what you should pursue. And I think that there isn't a sufficient appreciation, sometimes even in law, that people's practices cannot be as separated from their beliefs. All too often, English courts have said, oh, well, that isn't a core belief. Marriage isn't a core belief for a Christian. This such and such isn't a core belief. A, I don't think the court should be intervening in that kind of theological discussion about what's the most important thing. But B, I don't think they can understand how you can't separate certain beliefs out from others. You can't say, yes, you can have all these propositional beliefs you want about God, don't behave accordingly. A totalitarian state can be very happy with Christians who keep quiet. They can believe what they want if they never express their belief in thought, word, or deed. Well, thought's all right, but not word or deed. They're happy. But that isn't, I think, at all what we in a free society should want. Religion, therefore, is under attack, and that's for some reason, I think, why religious freedom itself is often under attack, because religious freedom isn't regarded as of special importance. A religious conscience isn't seen as being of particular weight. Even in 2007, the Council of Europe, which of course stands behind the European Convention of Human Rights and the European Court, says states must require, I like that word, require, religious leaders to take an unambiguous stand in favour of the precedence of human rights as set forth in the European Convention of Human Rights over any religious principle. Now, you just think that's what the Council of Europe, representing all European parliaments, is saying. Religious leaders should accept that religious principles are overridden by human rights. And plenty of people think that. And that's why I think even amongst religious people, sometimes there's a fear of the notion of human rights. Now, I want here and now to say that that is absolutely wrong, because human rights are include the right to religious freedom. One of the most basic of all human rights, Americans would call it the first freedom. It's the first freedom mentioned in the First Amendment to the US Constitution. The most basic right of all, I think, is religious freedom. Why is it the most basic right? Because, as I've already indicated, if you can't believe something and act accordingly when it's what you think most important in life, when you think it's what's best in life to pursue, if you can't pursue it, you haven't got any real freedom. It affects everything in life. You can't, I would say, and this is the start of a long argument, but you can't have real political freedom, you can't have real economic freedom if you haven't got religious freedom. It's not surprising that totalitarian states always attack religious freedom. Religious freedom sets a standard of authority outside the state for a start, but it also means that people themselves are free to think what's important. They don't have to take the state's word for it. And a lot of states, of course, don't want that. So freedom is important in a democracy. It's a prerequisite of democracy. Religious freedom is a prerequisite for all freedom. Religious freedom is a prerequisite for all democracy. And I think it's terribly important. Once religious freedom is being restricted, all freedoms are under attack. Another reason why I think this juxtaposition of religion versus human rights is so wrong is, what do human rights depend on? Why are human rights important? Well, I would link the notion of human rights very much with the notion of human dignity, actually. But why is that? Why do humans have dignity? A lot of people don't think they do. I mean, they just think that we're an evolved animal, and perhaps intelligent chimpanzees are worth more than some humans. I've come across philosophers arguing that very seriously. I would say human dignity is of paramount importance. Why? Why do humans have rights? Again, let me reference the United States. The notion of inalienable rights there was that they were endowed by our Creator. And that comes, I think, very much from the early Enlightenment in this country. I think there are two Enlightenments, in a sense. An early Enlightenment that started off, and by this country I mean the United Kingdom, we started off very much, I think, by noting the question that freedom is important, but that freedom was based on God's gift of freedom to us. John Locke was one of the greatest liberal philosophers. He wrote in the 17th century. He was the founding philosopher of the Glorious Revolution, William and Mary, 1688. He was also a great influence on Thomas Jefferson and the founding of the United States. He had an enormous political influence, and he's known as a science-based empiricist philosopher. But he was also a committed Christian. His whole writing, if you look at it, is suffused with an idea that everything depends on God, and that all things come from him. He was a devout Anglican himself. He was influenced by the so-called Cambridge Platonists, a group of philosophers and theologians in Cambridge in the 17th century, whose slogan was, "Reason is the candle of the Lord," a slogan that Locke himself refers to several times. It's a nice slogan because it suggests that reason doesn't give us a tremendous searchlight, so it's a flickering light, a pale light, so we don't see everything clearly. But nevertheless, such reason as we have is the gift of God and rooted in God's rationality. So there we have the invocation of reason very much an Enlightenment thing, but based on a theology that says God is the root and guarantor of all reason. Very different from the later Enlightenment in France, which became very much more atheistic and materialistic. I think even so, it's worth mentioning that the slogan of the French Revolution, Liberté, Égalité, Fraternité, is very much, well, I think it's impossible to understand unless you see how it's rooted in Christianity. Now, the people who use that slogan were very often opposing Christianity, particularly what they saw as the stifling tradition and authority of the Catholic Church. But if you look at each of those words, liberty, freedom, why are we free? Because we have free will given us by God. That was certainly Locke's view. Egality, one of the things we're talking about particularly today. Why are we equal? Why do humans have dignity? Surely because we're all equal in the sight of God. One of the verses I like in the New Testament is that in Christ there's neither Jew nor Greek, bond nor free, male nor female. We're all equal. We all have equal standing in the sight of God. Now, what the implications of that are for Christians and for others, of course, is a large discussion. But we start with that. Equality is not a secular notion. It's a deeply Christian notion. Fraternity, well, how on earth can you talk about brotherhood without a common father? Or sisterhood, either. That shouts a Christian origin. And like so much else in Europe, you cannot understand our origins or our beliefs nowadays unless you see how it's all rooted in our Christian past. Even the German atheist philosopher Habermas talks about the importance of the Christian heritage in Europe. You can't understand what's going on without understanding that. And a corollary, of course, is if you destroy that Christian heritage, what else changes? I don't even believe that human rights are safe. If you knock away their foundations, why do we believe in human rights? A lot of philosophers I know say we believe in human rights because we believe in human rights. And I'm not exaggerating. That's what we do. But a lot of people in the world don't believe in human rights. The Chinese don't. So what arguments have we got? What have we got to say to them? They would say, it's just Western imperialism. You're imposing your views on us. But I think there are reasons why humans should be treated as if they have dignity. Now, recent developments in the United Kingdom have tended, I think, to put issues of human rights and equality, perhaps following Europe, above any idea of freedom of religion. And this is what, again and again, I want to emphasize this morning, that to oppose human rights to freedom of religion is not to understand human rights properly, because human rights include, above all, the right to freedom of religion. I was lecturing in Russia not very long ago, and I was not perhaps altogether surprised to see that although religion is to some extent flourishing, particularly at the public level in the sense that the state is embracing Russian Orthodoxy, as communism did not, nevertheless, Russian Orthodoxy is very jealous of its position. It's quite happy to let questions of security be decided by the state, and it's quite happy for the state to prescribe organizations that they think are under Western influence. I was told, for instance, that one of the organizations that was regarded as dangerous and prescribed by the state was the Methodist Church. And, their reasoning is American, South Korean money. I said to a senior official in the Russian Orthodox Church, but the Methodist Church was founded in England. He just looked at me blankly. That didn't matter. Obviously, it was American influence and therefore to be very much guarded against. But, you see, that's allowing very little religious freedom. And it's not surprising, therefore, that you find that what's happening in Putin's Russia is that other freedoms are becoming more and more limited. The more the state sets itself up to decide who will have what freedom, even the most basic freedoms, the more all freedom is in danger. In one of the lectures I gave there in the Faculty of Philosophy in St. Petersburg University, the chairman got very agitated because he said that I was opposing relativism. a thing I've opposed all my career. I wrote a book about it first in 1973, and since then relativism has increased and increased in popularity, and so I don't feel my writings have done much good. But never mind. Relativism is almost in the air we breathe now. You shouldn't impose your views on other people. Your views are right for you, your community, not for us, etc. There is no objective truth. And yet, he said, well, you're saying that relativism is wrong, and he thought it was wrong, and yet you're allowing other views to flourish. You believe something is true, but you're letting opposing views flourish. How can you do such a thing, he said. Well, I was in a sense slightly surprised, because I thought that Russia was beginning to see the importance of democracy, and then I realised perhaps I was being too optimistic. Of course, that's pure Leninism. It's also the attitude of some Christians under the Catholics and the Church, for instance, and in the Inquisition. The idea that we know what's best for you, we know you're going to hell, we must stop you going to hell, we'll make sure that you actually, or we'll do our best to make sure you change your beliefs so that we make you believe what we think is right. Now, I think that there's definite progression from believing that something is true to actually thinking that you should impose it on other people. It's because I believe certain things are true that I don't want to impose my views on other people. One of the things I believe is true is that God has given us free will, and that should be respected. So freedom, is, if you believe it, is God-given. It should be respected in all people. If you look at the New Testament, I really believe you often see that Jesus let people go. He didn't, and he certainly didn't use his power to make people believe. That was one of the temptations, of course. So all of the time, you'll find that Jesus sorrowed, but he let the rich young ruler go, for instance. And you'll find, therefore, that freedom for a Christian involves respecting other people's right to go wrong as you see it. So freedom and truth aren't at war with each other, because part of what we believe is true is the importance of freedom. And I think that's of crucial importance. So I think that we must be very careful, therefore, not to go along too much with the secular idea, which I've already mentioned, of neutrality of the state. Where do people stand? Where does the state stand if it's neutral? The answer is, by definition, nowhere. All views flourish, and that's going to be impossible. We've already seen Theresa May talking about religious extremism and the importance of British values. What are British values? I think if you want to more or less say, let's subtract ourselves from all religion, from our Christian heritage, and still talk about British values, you've got a problem. I do think British values are fundamentally Christian values, that they're the values that have been brought to the British Isles for, 1,500 more years ago. And we're steeped in them. The common law is steeped in these values. Things that we take for granted, justice, mercy, they actually are quite substantive things, even equality, freedom. They're very substantive beliefs that aren't held all through the world, and yet they're rooted in a Christian outlook. Subtract them from that outlook, you not only turn them in on themselves in a very dangerous way, they've got nowhere to stand, you've got no reason to believe in them anymore. So neutrality is, I think, of a great danger. And again, Europe, I think, has been treading this path. The Treaty of Lisbon demonstrated considerable resistance to mentioning Christianity. And it merely refers to the cultural, religious, and humanist inheritance of Europe. It won't refer to Christianity. The French didn't want that particularly, and the Spanish socialists. So we're cut off from our history. We're deprived of any rational underpinning for our concern for rights, or for any belief in freedom, for any belief in equality. All those beliefs have been formed by the Christian heritage of Europe, sometimes painfully, sometimes gradually. Our own country particularly has been formed by it. Subtract that and everything changes. Now, in this, I think, again, it's important to see that freedom involves democracy. Democracy is, in a sense, a way of managing freedom and the inevitable disagreements that will come from it. A pluralist society is a society where people disagree. It shouldn't be a relativist society where you think that in the end nothing matters, everybody must decide for themselves, there is no truth. Democracy should be about how we decide ourselves what, in fact, we all collectively will accept as the true and act on it. And for that, everybody must contribute their beliefs to that democracy. And that's why democracy is terribly important as a means of protecting conscience in general and the religious conscience in particular. I'm very alarmed by many recent acts of Parliament that don't allow enough scope for the operation of conscience, that there is no real ability to balance rights against each other, recognise people have a right to religious freedom and act in accordance with it. No real way of having what I would term a reasonable accommodation. That's a term of art that's been coming in a bit more in law. I think it first became popular in Canada, and I've talked to lots of Canadians about this, and yet I think it does say something about the importance of how to balance rights, because I'm not here to say other people don't have rights, only religious people. I'm not here to pursue a sexual interest to make sure religious people do down everybody else. All I'm saying is that religious people have rights too, and they should be balanced. I don't want to go into particular law cases particularly much. We may talk about that later in the day. There was a group of cases that went to the European courts not long ago, four cases. Two were about the wearing of crosses, and I think, incidentally, the argument about symbols in a public place is very often proxy for the argument about the place of religion as a whole in public. But one of them was about a civil registrar who had a conscientious objection to registering civil partnerships. I don't think that example itself is crucial. The point was that she had a religiously informed conscience about something, and she was told that that had to be trumped by other people's rights. Now, she could have been accommodated in the circumstances. Other colleagues could have registered those civil partnerships, and she could have done on the job she'd always been doing. There was no question that, in fact, things couldn't have gone on perfectly, but Islington Council wanted to make a political point, and therefore they sacked her. Now, that's the kind of situation where I think reasonable accommodation is important. Conscience should be respected, and the reason why conscience should be respected is quite simply that in a pluralist society, if people can't act in accordance with their conscience and argue in accordance with it, in the end, democracy is in danger. So there, for one right to trump another, is, I think, very dangerous. Why does religious freedom matter? I could talk at great length about a science called the cognitive science of religion, which shows that religion is deeply rooted in human nature. I've been involved in research in Oxford recently about that. But let me just say, religion is always the default option across the world and across time. Atheism is a very sophisticated view. Atheism is a bit more like theology, reflecting on things. People, children, other tribes naturally see things in a religious way. It's there, deeply written in our human nature. I could talk a lot about that. But it's there. If religion is attacked, one of the springs of religion in human nature is being stifled. And that itself is something that's very bad for human flourishing. So as Christians, I think we should be very concerned about this attack on our own values. The secular attack, which tries to be neutral and ends up by being not just neutral against, but often very actively opposed to all religion. And in this, let me just finish by saying, it's terribly important to realise that if we're talking about religion and secularisation, and particularly Christianity and secularisation, it's very important to see that all Christians are on the same side in this, that Christianity is being picked on. It's not going to be Presbyterianism that's picked on, or even Catholicism. It's Christianity that's being targeted. And therefore, it behoves us to actually cooperate with all our fellow Christians where we can, because we're all facing the same constraints. Not very long ago, I was at an ecumenical international conference in Rome. And in the morning, the speakers, and I was one of them, were taken off to meet the Pope, Pope Francis. And it was explained to him that this conference organised by Georgetown University in Washington, which is a Jesuit university and with whom I've been working on religious freedom, that they were organising all this in conjunction with Baylor University, a Baptist university in the United States. And this was explained to the Pope, and when the word Baptist was mentioned, he smiled broadly and nodded very vigorously, as if to say, yes, yes, we're all on the same side here. Now, I think that that's a very important change. If I mentioned the Inquisition earlier, that just shows how things have changed. From the very top in the Catholic Church, there is not just an eagerness to fight for religious freedom, and the reason that the Pope wanted to see us was to give his imprimatur to the notion of religious freedom across the world. And it's under threat, particularly in Iraq, Syria, places like that at the moment. But not only that, he wanted to stress himself, his willingness to work with other Christians. So I hope we as Christians are open to working with our fellow Christians too. Thank you very much.